Chapter 71. "Since when can you drive?" Ozla asked Mab as they motored out of York. "My husband taught me." Mab took a sharp bend with confident speed. "He's Australian, grew up 800 miles from anything important and 400 miles from anything at all, so he learned to drive in the cradle." Ozla slanted a glance at her. "What did you tell him about this day trip? Visit to an old friend? The best lies have the most truth." "That's certainly true." They exchanged guarded glances as the Bentley halted at a four-way stop. "Maybe we can get through this day without flashing any more claws," Ozla thought. "You didn't used to wear trousers," Mab said with a glance at Ozla's sleek red slacks. "They made you look squat. This prolonged rationing is such a blessing for some people." "You're not in Casablanca," Ozla shot back. "So stop wearing your hat over one eye like a third-rate Ingrid Bergman." Mab glared. As they climbed up into the high moors, Ozla outlined the route to Clockwell. "About a two-hour drive. And when we get there?" Mab steered the Bentley round a bend. "How are we getting in?" Ozla outlined her plan. "The matron on telephone duty shouldn't have told me so much, but I detoured her onto a nice long gossip about the royal wedding, and there's really nothing most women won't tell you right now in exchange for royal wedding gossip. I let it slip that the bridal bouquet would be myrtle and lilies, and I tell you, that woman was mine." "Is the bridal bouquet going to be myrtle and lilies?" "How the blithering hell should I know? I made it up. As for getting admitted to visiting hours without identification." Ozla ticked through the last details. "If they double down on us, we start up the waterworks. We're so distressed to be coming here. Doctor, please, we've come all this way." Ozla dabbed an imaginary handkerchief. "It's amazing what men, even doctors, will do to get weeping women off their hands." "You can cry on command?" "Of course, frightfully useful." A pall fell over the car, maybe just a cloud sliding across the sun. "What do you think will happen?" Ozla heard herself ask. Mab stared straight ahead. "We'll realize Beth's mad as a hatter and be off the hook." "That's what you hope will happen. Rather beastly of you too," Ozla couldn't help adding. "I'm a beastly person, Oz. That's been made abundantly clear lately. By you, by my..." She stopped, jaw set. "In some ways, I'm glad you're beastly." Ozla curled her feet beneath her. "If Beth's not mad and not lying, we're going to have to put things right. I'd much rather have a cast-iron bitch on my side for that fight than a fainting ninny." "Get your shoes off the seat." Ozla ignored her. "Who do you think the traitor is?"
"Maybe it's you," Mab suggested.
"Do shut up. The traitor... Look here. Do we have to go on saying the traitor? I feel like I'm in an Agatha Christie novel, and not in a good way." "I'm floored at all points here, trying to imagine a good way to be in an Agatha Christie novel."
"You're the corpse in chapter one," Mab suggested, smirking.
The car was winding further into the fells. "You're very nearly enjoying this," Ozla observed. "That must have been quite the up-and-downer with your husband, if you're on the verge of enjoying a drive to a lunatic asylum with me, darling." That got her a withering look. "Just the glare, no quip. You're losing your touch, Queen Mab." Maybe Ozla could enjoy this moment too, just a bit. "If I call the traitor the informer instead, will you keep glaring?"
"I will allow informer."
"Topping of you. What if the informer is someone we know?"
"If Beth knew them," Mab replied grimly, "we probably do too. Odds are it's a woman."
"How do you figure that?"
"There were more of us at BP, and people don't suspect women."
"Don't talk slush," Ozla snorted. "We can't walk off alone with a man without being called fast. We can't check into a hotel without suspicion we're there for hanky-panky."
"People suspect women of hanky-panky," Mab corrected. "But they never suspect women of espionage. No one thinks women can keep secrets.
What are the three fastest means of communication?" Ozla quoted the old joke. Then she and Mab chanted the answer together. "Telegraph, telephone, telewoman."
"You have no idea how I hate that joke," Mab said.
"Darling, I have a very good idea." They fell silent. The car scraped past an elderly farm truck trundling along an exposed spine of country road, mud splatting across the windscreen. "Why did you settle in Yorkshire, of all places?" Ozla asked.
"Because my husband got a job here. And because it was far away from London and Bletchley, Mab said shortly. Because it had no memories at all. Ozla twisted the big emerald around her finger. You said you had a family now. A blast. She couldn't ask if Mab had children, given the phantom that was little Lucy hovering between them. It would drive the knife into the hilt. I have twins, Mab said unexpectedly. 18 months old. The flash of love through her face was the first softening Ozla had seen since clapping eyes on her yesterday. I'm happy for you, Ozla said honestly. What are their names? Edward, Eddie, and Lucy. Ozla felt the phantom glide of a little girl's wrist wrenching out of her grip. Mab, don't. Ozla looked straight ahead to the road twisting down the slope. Go on hating me, she said. I hope it helps. I don't hate you, Oz. Mab's eyes were invisible behind her huge sunglasses. I try not to feel much of anything these days, love or hate. I love Eddie and Lucy, because you can't help loving your children, and that's how it should be. But it's easier if I don't feel much of anything for anyone else. Easier to do what? Endure. They motored on in silence. Chapter 72 12th November, 9 days before Beth's surgery, for which she'd been receiving increasing examinations, 8 days before the royal wedding, which the nurses blathered about endlessly. They say the bridesmaids are wearing white, but with the princess wearing white. Chattering and chattering as Beth sat with her go-partner, desperately trying to engage the woman. Just one move, the black stone. Nothing. Would you rather try chess? Beth laid out the chessboard. Remember when you first taught me how to turn a pawn into a queen? Nothing. The woman who had played chess like a grandmaster now sat utterly still, utterly vacant, occasionally shitting herself. Her eyes were blank as shaded windows. It can't end this way, Beth screamed inside. Not for you, and not for me either. It can't. But then it came. Special treat for you, Miss Liddell, the matron cooed. A vice for my head. Then the whine of a drill, the wet shoving sound of a surgical tool cutting through her brain. Had they moved the procedure up? Panic hit Beth in a wave, and the chessboard upended in a scatter of black and white pieces as she tried to run. Chapter 73 Only a 2-hour drive to the asylum, but everything had gone wrong. A road was washed out, and they had to detour for hours. A tyre blew, then a torrential downpour of rain hit. That snaffles it, Ozla had seethed. Visiting hours will be done by the time we arrive. She and Mab had ended up spending a resentful night at a drab hotel 2 miles from Clockwell, and making their way through the asylum gates the following morning. Mab steered the Bentley through the grounds and parked in the indicated lot. There was no trouble about their names or any request for identification when Mab and Ozla strode in with their most confident swing of hips and handbags. Here to see our sister, Alice Liddell, Mrs. Riley and Mrs. Chadwick, giving the names of Beth's married sisters. The matron at the front desk rose. I'll show you to her. We do ask, of course, that you not mention your sister's upcoming surgery during the visit. Ozla's heart began to thud. What surgery? This place had looked so friendly when they rolled up. A mellow stone country house with 2 extended wings, surrounded by rambling gardens. Now the bright winter light streaming through the windows looked glaring, a spotlight to cut down anyone who passed through it. The surgery was discussed with her parents, as her next of kin. It's a procedure that has had tremendous success improving the temperament of moody or emotionally distressed patients. Simple surgical severance of the connections between the... In English, please, Mab said. Ozla gripped the edge of the desk, pulse beating ominously. It's a new wave in advanced treatment of the mentally impaired. Much more common in America, but our new chief physician is versed in the latest techniques. The matron smiled. It's called a lobotomy. What's a lobotomy? The word gave Ozla the shivers. A harmless procedure, I assure you. Your sister will be much the better for it. Twinkle. Now, come with me. The garden was dry and dead, but white-smocked, empty-eyed women still wandered through it. "Patients have the grounds in the afternoon for exercise." Osler ignored the matron. They'd been brought to wait beside the stone benches in the center of the rose bushes, and she was about to see Beth, on whom she hadn't laid eyes in 3.5 years. At her side, she could see Mab blinking too rapidly for calm, though she was the picture of elegance with her smartly slanted hat. "No!" A raspy voice startled Osler, the edge of desperation so sharp it raised her hackles. "I don't want a treat. I know where you're taking me. You silly girl, your sisters are here." A nurse's exasperated voice approached through the roses. "Don't you want to see them?" Beth stumbled into the center of the rose garden and stopped dead. Osler and Mab froze too. This was Beth. Their old billet mate who had transformed herself from a beaten-down spinster in a moth-coloured jumper to a star codebreaker with a Veronica Lake wave. This woman looked like a haunted house apparition, stripped down to bones and tendons and raw, raging will. Beth's nails were bitten bloody, her blonde hair chopped at her shoulders, where she fidgeted constantly with its ragged ends. She started violently at every sound, yet Osler didn't think she looked afraid. She looked too maddened to know what fear was, a writhing mess held barely upright by fury. "She had a bout of pneumonia this spring," the matron said, a touch defensively, seeing their horror. "That's why she's so thin. I'll leave you, shall I? Visits last 1 hour." She bustled off. Beth stood staring at the pair of them, and Osler's nose prickled at the smell of sweat, fear, infrequent washing. Beth began, her voice raspier than it had once been, and stopped. "Don't look at me. I'm not used to being looked at. Well, doctors look. They look all the time, and the inmates are always watching, but the doctors and inmates don't expect you to behave logically. You need me to be logical, or else you're going to walk out thinking I belong here, and I don't." She ran out of breath, speaking in a monotone, almost too fast to follow. "Beth?" Somehow Osler found herself sitting on the bench, crossing her ankles and indicating the seat opposite for Beth, as if they were sitting down to tea. "Back straight, girls," she could hear her old finishing school teachers cry. "There's no social disaster that can't be remedied with good manners. We're here, and we're listening." Osler kept her voice as calm as possible. Beth gulped again. Mab took the seat beside Osler, and Osler could read the flicker of her eyes like newsprint. "Insane?" Mab was wondering. "Or terrified?" Osler leaned forward. There was no one close enough to eavesdrop. She could finally ask, "Who is the traitor?" And the word didn't sound this time like something from a melodrama. It sounded like truth. "Giles Talbot," Beth said, and horror drenched Osler in an icy flood. "No," she thought, "it can't be Giles, it can't." But the words were spilling from Beth in a torrent. She looked mostly at the roses as she spoke, and her recitation had a clipped haste, as though she'd imagined this moment too long not to rush delivering it. At last she fell silent. Osler looked at Mab and knew they were both picturing irrepressible red-headed Giles with a ludicrously decked-out top hat and a plate of bread and marge. Giles, who had apparently been here just yesterday, threatening Beth. Osler looked down at her clenched hands. Whatever she'd been expecting Beth to say, it wasn't this. "He was always angling for gossip." Mab disordered the carefully set waves of her hair with a rake of one hand. "Not trying to charm it out of you, just being cozy. He liked to tell a woman he was in love with someone else," Beth said. "It made them feel safe, or it made them feel competitive, but either way they'd talk. He once told me he was head over heels for you." Mab looked at Beth, startled. "He once told me he was head over heels for you," Osler managed to say, looking at Mab. "We all trusted him," said Beth. "He's the goods, all right." Osler heard her voice come out very small as she looked down at the emerald on her finger. "He's also my fiancé." Midway through 44, going with Giles to see the Glenn Miller band near Bletchley Park, jitterbugging to Chattanooga Choo Choo, taking nips from Giles's flask, trying to banish the memory of dancing with Philip, trying to banish the bloody heartbreak, letting Giles kiss her when the music swung into In the Mood.
I know what I'm in the mood for, Giles had murmured in her ear.
He'd been chafing her, trying to get a hint what she'd been translating in Hut 4, but she hadn't given him a word. And when marvellous, unbeatable Glenn Miller changed the tune, so did Giles.
Come on, Oz, you've got someone you'd like to forget. Why not give it a try with me?
And Ozla, a little sauced and wholly heartsick, had thought, why the hell not? Because what had been good ever got her, except here, heartbroken and wretched? So they nipped off to Giles's car and climbed in the back seat, and it was all finished 4 minutes later. And Ozla felt no different, except to think all the fuss about it had clearly been a loss of sound and fury, signifying nothing, like the whole idea of romance to begin with. This is all you get, she thought. This is all there is. Giles hadn't seemed to expect much, just gave her a comradely smack on the flank and then drove her home. He'd gone on being exactly the same, a good friend, an occasional date, even a roll in the hay now and then after the war. Funny, exasperating Giles, who had slouched toward her at exactly the right moment earlier this year, the moment she was on her beam ends, thinking she might as well marry just to get on with life, and said,
"Let's give it a go, Oz. Romance is for bad novels, but marriage is for pals, pals like us. What do you say?"
Once again, she'd thought, why the hell not, and let him park an emerald on her finger. And here she was, listening to an old enemy tell her that her future husband was a traitor to the crown.
"Your fiancé!"
Beth had gone so white she looked ready to faint.
"He told me just yesterday that he'd have a family soon. He didn't say..."
She broke off, ripping at her nails.
"Did you tell him I'd sent you a message? Did you tell him you were coming here?"
"No." And why hadn't she? Ozla couldn't help wondering in the midst of her shock. Giles knew about Beth and Bletchley Park. It was one of the appeals of marrying him, that she wouldn't have to tell whoppers about her war years. Ozla could have asked his advice when she deciphered Beth's Visionaire Square. Why hadn't she? Something instinctive had sealed her mouth like a lock.
"You don't believe me?"
Beth's voice was bleak as she looked at Ozla.
"You believe him?"
Ozla opened her mouth, not even knowing what she was going to say, but memories were slotting themselves into place with the sudden click of keys turning in locks.
"June 42, when I was hauled into Commander Travis's office about those missing files," she said slowly. "Travis said someone reported me."
"Giles," said Beth. "He told me. He said you nearly caught him, more than once. Something about the Hut 4 box files."
Ozla thought of that whisk of coat disappearing just out of sight. I knew it was something fishy. But the realization brought no pleasure. Mab took up the thread. "There was a night, after I was transferred to the mansion, when Giles kept pouring drinks into me at the recreation hut. I was a bloody mess. I had a set of keys that locked up the file cabinets. He said I'd turn them into the watchman after leaving the recreation hut, but I didn't remember. He had himself a rummage through the mansion's files when you were drunk."
Beth's voice was hard. "He turned the keys in, but not before having a good poke around."
Mab went white too, and Ozla could tell she was passing what kinds of reports would have been accessible with those keys. Her chin lifted, and Ozla saw her paleness was fury.
"He used me," she clipped. "He used me, he stole from me, then he comforted me.
And he turned us against Beth," Ozla thought. Something stabbed her stomach again. This time it was shame. She looked at Beth, twitchy, wary, desperate, raw. Had she stayed entirely sane after more than 3 years in a place like this? Even if she was not entirely sane, she was still not wrong.
"I believe you," Ozla said.
"You..."
Beth's raspy new voice was barely a whisper.
"You do?"
Mab nodded too.
"We'll get you out."
Ozla checked for listeners. Their allotted hour was slipping away. "I'm going straight to London to report this. Once the wheels start to turn..."
"Too long. They're operating on me the day after the royal wedding. They will cut into my brain." Beth shivered violently. Please, you can't let them do that to me. Get me out now.
She managed to hold her gaze steady this time, not sliding sideways. Ozla and Mab exchanged glances.
I have a plan, Beth whispered. I spent 3.5 years watching the routines here. Tell me, did you get here by car or train?
And the heads came together among the dying roses. Chapter 74. Ozla was being charming, and Mab was being terrifying. And between the two of them, Beth dared to hope she might get out. Mab had collared 2 orderlies, the head matron and a doctor doing his rounds. I have serious concerns about my sister's health. Arms folded, scarlet fingernails drumming. If we can discuss your therapies. Ozla had gathered every nurse in sight and most of the inmates and was chattering like a breathless Mayfair magpie. 200 pounds of rose petals in the abbey alone. She'll be wearing an absolutely topping tiara of the Queen's for her something borrowed. Leaning forward confidentially, making the women lean in. You mustn't tell anyone, because Mr. Hartnell swore me to secrecy at my dress fitting, but the Queen will be wearing lilac silk, a real fizzer. How did you get invitations to the royal wedding? One of the matrons breathed. My husband rubs shoulders with some useful London people. We saw Prince Philip once, an absolute dream. No one was paying attention to Beth, lingering close, but not too close, to the locked gardening shed. Perhaps increased outdoor activity, Mab was suggesting to the doctor. He was visibly writhing to please her. My sister always loved working in the garden, if that would help with these mood swings you describe. Gauloise, anyone? Ozla passed her cigarette case around, throwing smiles like diamond chips. There's simply nothing like French cigarettes, French knickers, or French men. Now, the princess's bridesmaids, what kind of gardening tools do you have for the patients? Mab steered her entourage around to the shed. I'm sure my sister would improve if she could get her hands in the ground. Let me see what you have. The head matron unlocked the shed. Hanging inside was that set of keys that opened the small access doors, where the gardeners trundled wheelbarrows of dead leaves off grounds. The shed that had never once in the 3.5 years Beth had been watching it been left unattended, not for so much as a cigarette break. They say Princess Margaret will be in white organza, but I think she'll switch at the last minute to make a splash. Ozla broke off, patting her forehead. Oh, goodness, is anyone else warm? Glances at the cloudy sky. It's November, ma'am. The shed was open. Mab stepped inside to frown at the tools. You could use more spades and trowels. I'll speak to my husband about a donation. Tell me, what other supplies could the institution use?
Really, it seems quite warm.
Ozla's voice trailed upward uncertainly. She rose, frowning, and toppled over in a heap on the grass.
Doctor!
Beth screamed. Scream loud, Beth. We need every single head spinning in that moment to look at Ozla. The doctor jerked away from Mab and came at a trot. The nurses and even the inmates clustered around Ozla, who lay on the ground with her limbs twitching, head rolled back.
The doctors here have seen epileptic fits. Can't you just pretend you saw a spider? It will work, Beth.
Nurse, it's some kind of seizure. Hold her head.
Ozla twitched gently, not overdoing it.
You're good, Beth thought, hope beginning to hammer at her ribs. As soon as the distraction's underway, Mab moves.
With every eye on Ozla, Beth watched Mab's hand move to the key hook inside the shed.
The keys aren't labelled, but it will be one of the smaller ones. I don't know which. Grab them all. Are you sure you can get them off the ring without being seen?
It may have been a long time since I was pocketing lipsticks from Selfridges, but I've still got a fast swipe. Beth saw her arm move in a quick yank, and then Mab was shutting the shed doors and pushing into the crowd around Ozla.
My sister has always been prone to these little spells. Give her some air.
Ozla's eyelids fluttered. Mab helped her sit up. There were blushes, apologies. Oh, how too embarrassing, Doctor. One of the nurses, Beth saw from the corner of her eye, was hastily locking up the shed, not bothering to look inside. Doctors and orderlies fought to help Ozla up, and she drooped gracefully against all the solicitor's male arms.
Time to get my sister home, Mab announced,
and brushed through the crowd toward the house, a stream of nurses and patients moving with her. She and Beth managed to reach the door at the same time, jostling each other. Beth felt the three small keys press into her palm. After that, Beth, it's up to you. Don't rush it, Beth thought. Wait for Mab and Osler to be escorted out. Wait for the commotion from Osler's fit to die down, for the common room to settle. Wait for the nurses to fall back into their usual rounds. Wait. But what if the grounds crew goes back into the shed and they see... Beth squashed the panic. She'd waited for 3.5 years. She wasn't going to ruin everything now out of haste. Drifting slowly out of the common room, as if returning to her cell, drifting down the passage instead, whisking behind a curtain. The matrons at the front desk weren't supposed to leave the entrance unattended, but they did all the time. The patients were so quiet, there wasn't any real risk. And besides, there were the walls outside to contain them if they wandered into the grounds. Matron Rowe, on the desk today, couldn't go 40 minutes without a cigarette. Sure enough, she whisked round the corner after 15 patient minutes of waiting. Beth slipped outside, barely breathing. Down the stone steps. Beth remembered mounting those steps the day she came here, feeling like Alice fallen down the rabbit hole. I'm not Alice any longer, thought the former Miss Liddell. I am no longer trapped inside the clock. Drifting, not running, around the women's wing toward the back of the house, crouching under the windows. The access door came into sight, and Beth checked the clock tower. 10:30. The orderlies made rounds of the wall on the hour. She flung herself at the gate, fumbling the trio of keys out of her sleeve. First key didn't fit. She yanked it out, panting, fumbled with the second key, dropped it.
What are you doing here?
An orderly stood staring at her, stopped buttoning his coat over his uniform. Ginger-haired, scrawny, clearly off-duty and headed out. He was the one Beth had serviced in a linen closet, trying to learn what a lobotomy was, the one who had ruffled her hair afterward.
You shouldn't be out,
he began, coming toward her, and Beth didn't hesitate. She threw the useless key at his head, and as he flinched, she flung herself on him. He yelled in surprise, trying to fend her off, but she darted her head forward like a viper and sank her teeth into his cheek. The man yelped like he'd been scolded, and Beth forced her hand over his mouth, trying to contain the shout. He fell heavily, and Beth felt the impact along her entire left side as she fell with him, but her teeth only sank deeper. She heard herself making a mad, keening noise. All the helpless rage of the last 3.5 years boiled up her throat and roared when it met the coppery tang of the man's blood in her mouth. She tasted more than blood. She tasted the chalky flavour of sedative tablets and the antiseptic tang of nurse's fingers thrusting into her mouth to force her jaws apart. She tasted shame and despair and the urge to wind a bedsheet around her throat and hang herself. She tasted bleak, stony hatred for Giles and a blunter, smaller venom for the nurses and orderlies who bullied the inmates. She tasted the metal of the drill that would have cut her skull open and the tensile snapping of her brain strands as her code-breaking mind was mutilated.
Let go!
The orderly squealed into her ear, faces locked together as if they were dancing cheek to cheek.
Let go, you mad bitch! No!
Beth snarled through her teeth, clamped into his face, and managed to get her fingers into his hair to yank his head against the ground. She banged his head once, twice, and he went slack. She banged one more time to be sure. Beth's ears buzzed. Her jaws ached as she released her teeth, and she wiped an unsteady hand across her mouth, feeling blood smear. She looked at the unconscious man below her, his cheek torn open. She didn't know if it had been his head hitting the ground, or if he had fainted, but he was out cold. She checked his pulse. Strong. He was too heavy to move, and she had no way to hide him. She'd have to take her chances it would be a while before he was found. She got to her feet, shaking, and staggered back to the access door. Her hands trembled too much at first to fit the second key to the lock. Her mouth was still coppery with blood. The second key didn't fit. Please, Beth prayed, fitting the third. It turned. She was through the door in a flash, wedging it shut and locking it from the outside. Outside the walls, for the first time in 3.5 years. The path led down a grassy slope toward a road she'd never seen. Beth flew down it, legs pumping. She'd told them where to wait. If they weren't there, please, she prayed again. There was Osler, perched on the long hood of a forest green Bentley, hair ruffling in the cold breeze. Mab slouched behind the wheel, lighting a cigarette, saying, "Been trying to stop, but the week you stage an asylum breakout is not the week to quit smoking." They looked up, hearing her footsteps, and Beth saw them both flinch at the blood on her mouth. They tried to hide it, but she saw. For an instant, her step faltered. Osler slid off the hood and threw open the door. "Coming?" Beth crawled into the back seat, lying flat. She was suddenly dizzy, inhaling scents she hadn't smelled in years. Leather upholstery, Osler's Soir de Paris, Mab's Chanel No. 5. And her own smell, fear and ammonia and sweat. "I want a bath." Mab started the car up and they were swinging round. "Don't speed," Beth said. "We don't want to attract attention." "Hide under this," Osler ordered, shoving a car rug over the partition. Beth squirmed under it, but she couldn't resist a peek through the rear window as they turned off the asylum road. Just a big grey stone house behind a tangle of dead roses and high walls, receding into the distance. Sleeping Beauty's crumbling castle. The air coming through the open window was freezing cold, fragrant with bracken. Free air. "Lie down," Mab hissed, mashing the pedal. Beth lay down, head spinning. Mab and Osler were arguing, low-voiced. "Once they realise we aren't Beth's sisters, they have no blinking idea what our real names even are." The question burst out of Beth from under the blanket. "Can you tell me what happened to Boots?" A startled pause. Beth shrank, dreading the answer. "He was returned to Espley Guys after you were taken away," Osler said. "Our landlady kept him. She mentioned him in her last Christmas card." Beth squeezed her eyes shut. Her dog was alive, safe. That seemed like the best omen in the world. Mab spoke up then. "Where are we going, Beth?" Beth opened her mouth and closed it again. The first real decision she'd been offered in 3.5 years. The Bentley rocketed over the moor as Beth Finch shut her tear-filled eyes with a sob of joy. "Alice escaped the looking glass, Giles. And now she's coming for you." Chapter 75. Why did Giles get mixed up with the Soviets? Mab wondered, changing gears. The Bentley was speeding past Blackpool now, well south of York, even further from Clockwell. "We had more than a few at BP who flirted pink on the political side, but Giles didn't seem to have an ideological bone in his body. He thought BP wasn't doing enough to help our allies." Beth was sitting up in the back seat now, wearing a print dress from Mab's travelling case. It sagged off her gaunt frame. Osler had pressed a comb on her too, and some scent. "Not to put too fine of a point on it, darling, but you look like a dog's dinner." "He saw an opportunity to help the Soviets win their war, so he did. In his eyes," she spat the words, "he was a patriot." "The PM was stingy about sharing our findings with the Soviets," Osler pointed out. "I used to get in a wax about that too." "Yes, but you didn't betray your country," Beth said. "Would I feel quite so defensive of my country if it had locked me up in a madhouse?" Mab wondered. Because Giles might have planted the seeds, but it was BP's obsession with secrecy that made Beth's imprisonment possible. Then again, Beth had always had that peculiar rigid streak. It didn't matter that her country had betrayed her. She'd taken an oath to it, and she would uphold that oath until she died. Maybe that streak of unbending iron in her soul was what had kept her from crumbling, surrounded by lunatics. "We could contact Commander Travis first," Osler began. "He's living in Surrey now. He knows us. And with his connections, contact with MI5 would..."
"No!"
Beth cut her off.
"No, Travis. No MI5. Not yet."
Mab took her eyes off the road long enough to stare.
"We need to regularize your position as soon as possible. We've already risked charges breaking you out. You put me there to begin with," Beth flared.
The undercurrent that had been running through the Bentley snapped taut.
"Beth."
Osler reached to touch Beth's hand where it rested on the backseat partition, then apparently thought better of it.
"We didn't know they were thinking of sending you to a sanitarium. If we'd known that when we were questioned, I lost 3.5 years of my life because you two were angry at me."
Beth's fingers flexed and opened, flexed and opened.
"Have I been punished enough to suit you? Do you have any idea what it was like in Clockwell? Of course I don't."
Mab stamped on the brakes as they came to a 4-way stop, harder than necessary, so they all jolted in their seats.
and I'd never have wished it on you in 1,000 years, no matter how much bad blood we had between us. All I'm saying is that if you want to sling blame, that goes both ways, so I suggest we don't, because it doesn't matter. The person guilty of a crime here, a real crime, is Giles Talbot, and Osler and I are here to help you deal with him. So why can't we go to the authorities immediately?
Beth drew something from her pocket and swung it between two fingers, a small brass key.
Because I still need to break the Rose Code.
Chapter 76. It was past 10 by the time they motored through Buckinghamshire, the Bentley creeping along pitch-black country roads. They had all fallen silent some 30 miles back, at about the time, Beth knew, when they drew closest to Bletchley Park.
I haven't seen it since I left for the Admiralty in autumn of 44, Mab said abruptly.
It was still buzzing along like clockwork. We had thousands of workers by that point. Remember the early days, when everything felt so ramshackle and you knew every face at shift change?
I was let go September 45, Osler said. That cruel little form, owing to the cessation of hostilities, etc., etc. Please bugger off, and never talk about what you did here, or you'll be hanged, drawn, and quartered.
A sigh.
The clear-out was starting even before I left. They sent a party of us back to the old Hut 4, made us crawl over every board. People used to jam bits of decrypts into the cracks in the walls when drafts were blowing. We had to find every scrap and burn them.
Part of Beth yearned to stop by Bletchley Park's gates, and part of her was glad it was too dangerous to risk being seen so near her hometown. She didn't know if she could bear to see BP empty and abandoned.
We did such things there, and no one will ever know.
They made the turn off in silence and parked, unfolding stiffly from the car. Beth didn't know when she'd ever been so tired. This morning she'd wakened in her cell. By noon she was out. They'd driven all afternoon and through the evening across most of England. Had all of that really happened in one day? Mab rang at the door of the darkened house for a long time. At last there was the creak of hinges.
"What's this about?" came the alarmed voice of Dilly Knox's widow. "Has there been an accident?"
"No accident." Beth came forward, seeing the older woman's eyes widen.
"I'm very sorry to disturb you, Mrs. Knox, but it's an emergency. 3.5 years ago, I locked something in your husband's safe. I've come to retrieve it."
Beth could feel Dilly so strongly as she came into the library, she nearly broke down in tears.
"I didn't fail you," she thought, moving past his battered wing chair. "I didn't give in."
Osler and Mab stood back, watching as Beth went to the wall and opened the panel. A deep breath, looking at the safe door and inserting the key. Beth felt the quiet click at the base of her heart, as well as in her ears. She heard the intake of breath from the others as she reached inside and took out the rose file.
"That's it," Osler whispered.
Beth took the file to Dilly's big oak desk and spread out the pages. The sight of the familiar five-letter blocks of Enigma brought a wave of memory that nearly knocked her off her feet. It made some feline sleeping part of her brain uncoil, stretching and hungry. She laid out the pages, starting with the single message she'd broken, and run through the Typex on her very last day at the park, and realized her hands weren't fumbling anymore, but moving with swift precision.
"Come look,"
she ordered, and the others obeyed, reading over her shoulder the words she'd had memorized for years. Osler was the first to see the problem.
"We," she said succinctly, "are utterly graveled. It doesn't name him."
Mab looked ready to spit nails. "Did he realize that?"
"He didn't know what I had."
Beth tapped the words, "your source inside ISK."
"Without a name, it's not proof enough to take him down."
"But he moved against you as soon as you found this out. He got you locked up so you couldn't bring this to Travis."
Mab picked up the decrypt.
"That proves it's him."
"He can say the source inside ISK was me, that I was the one about to move against him.
If he flips it round, it doesn't sound any less plausible than our version. And he's the one with a respected career, not a twitching woman escaped from a madhouse."
"But the accusation would taint him."
Osler nibbled a varnished fingernail.
"That's the kind of thing that destroys careers.
Especially after I cram his emerald down his throat and start ballyhooing his guilt to every influential connection I've got. And I have got heaps."
He might lose his post. He might live under a cloud. But I'd still go back to Clockwell and face having my brain scrambled.
Beth looked up, certainty hardening.
We need more before we go to MI5. I need more. I want something with his name on it, something he can't lie his way out of. One of these.
She found the undecrypted messages out on the desk.
Might have that. I hope. I need to crack them, and I need to do it now.
Mab's fingers drummed.
How long before he realizes you've escaped?
The asylum will notify MI5 that I'm gone. But Giles wasn't their contact on file. Someone else is handling my case. So even though MI5 will be casting their nets for me, Giles won't be told I...
He'll find out, Mab stated. You know we'll have your name flagged. Any changes, any unexpected developments. Your handler will tell him you're gone, and then what? He sits around waiting, gives you all the time you need to break this cipher.
Maybe he won't find out. Osler looked thoughtful. Just after Giles and I became engaged, I asked him if he could make inquiries at work, find out what had become of Beth.
You did?
Beth asked, surprised. You think I've gone 3.5 years without once thinking of you? Of course I wanted to know. Giles did some digging, but they wouldn't tell him anything. Something about conflicting interests, given that he'd been your friend, Osler quoted. So if he told you he could get reassigned to your case any time he wanted, I think he was talking slush. He might have charmed the Clockwell doctors into giving him information about you, but it didn't work on his superiors at MI5. They didn't tell him anything then, and I don't think they'll tell him you've escaped now, no matter what alerts he's tried to put in place.
Giles was lying to one of us.
Beth gnawed her lip.
What if it was you?
I don't think so. When he lies, it's to make himself look better, and he didn't like telling me he'd been dismissed like a schoolboy. He wants everyone to see him as a man who can pull strings, get anything.
It's still a risk, Mab said. Taking time to crack the rest of these messages.
We have no choice. If we go to MI5 now, without better evidence, he will squirm out of it.
Beth took a deep breath.
My surgery is scheduled for the day after the royal wedding. Giles said he'd telephone Clockwell that morning. If we count on MI5 keeping him out of the loop until then, 1 week.
Osler looked at the other two. The morning after the wedding, we go to MI5 with whatever we've got. 7 days to crack Rose and pin Giles Talbot to the wall. Beth had only broken the one message, and that had taken her months. The sheer cliff of the task loomed in front of her. They all jumped at the knock on the library door. Mrs. Knox came in, balancing a tray against her dressing-gowned hip.
Tea, she said, yawning. And I've opened up some bedrooms upstairs. Have at it, my dears, whatever it is. I'm going back to bed. Don't tell me a thing.
6 days until the royal wedding. November 14, 1947. Chapter 77.
Is she making any headway? Osler asked.
Hard to say.
Mab shook her head. Watching Beth work over the last 2 days had been fascinating and not a little disturbing. She'd taken over Dilly's big oak desk, drawing up cardboard strips called rods and haphazard lists of cribs. She broke endless pencils and drank endless pots of coffee. She held long conversations with her former mentor, as though he were actually sitting there.
What if... I tried that, Dilly. Did you ever try...
And then fell into hours of abstracted silence.
Is this how the Boffins did it during the war? Mab couldn't help asking dubiously.
She'd worked so many stages of the intelligence chain at BP, but she'd never been part of the stage where human brains made the critical initial breaks. As Mab watched, Beth scribbled something, scratched it out, swigged all the coffee in her cup and started over. She'd been going nearly 36 hours.
I can see why the intelligence watch thought BP people were all loons, Osler said, then winced at that particular choice of words.
But Beth hadn't noticed. Mab wasn't certain if Beth would notice if the house exploded. Her frayed hair had been pushed behind her ears, she had a flare of colour in her cheeks, and her eyes glistened like shards of glass. Frankly, she didn't look sane.
Is she actually doing anything? Mab wondered. Or are we watching a madwoman shuffle paper? Sometimes it takes months.
Beth spoke as if reading Mab's mind, not looking up from some chain of letters she was diagramming.
Well, we haven't got months, said Mab. Even if you get the wheel settings, how can you decrypt it without an Enigma machine or a Type-X?
The machines were all shipped out of BP at the end of the war, Osler mused. Broken up for scrap.
With thousands of Enigmas and Type-Xs and bombs, you'd think at least some would have survived.
But Mab wasn't sure how they'd find out. You couldn't just go around asking where top-secret decoding machines were kept.
I wonder if my Uncle Dickie can turn something up. He's in India now, but maybe his old Admiralty aides.
Osler turned with a flip of her skirt, heading for the hall telephone. Beth looked up so abruptly, Mab started. It took her a while to focus on Mab's face.
Coffee?
Coming right up, Your Highness,
Mab said a little sourly. But she supposed there wasn't any other way she could help. She couldn't decrypt Rose. She had no powerful relations who could pull strings. She might as well make the coffee.
What am I even doing here? Mab wondered, heading for Corn's Woods Kitchens.
If that girl doesn't need more coffee, Mrs. Knox said from the kitchen sink, I'll eat my apron.
The woman certainly knew codebreakers.
She does.
Fresh pot already brewing. Help me with the washing up.
Mab tied a tea towel around her blue-sprigged cotton dress.
You put your feet up and let me do it, Mrs. Knox. It's the least we can do after invading your home. I like hearing the place lively again.
Mrs. Knox dried a teacup, looking pensive.
It's been nearly 5 years since my husband died.
I only met him in passing. I worked in another section, but I've heard he was a great man.
He was a great man, but maddening. Most great men are. The way he went through tobacco and pens, and dear me, the water bill for all those long hot baths when he was working through some problem.
Mrs. Knox shook her head, smiling.
I miss him.
A memory of Francis pierced Mab, his lathering up at the mirror in the Keswick Hotel. She blinked it away with a hard swallow.
Do you have more soap?
I'm afraid that little sliver is it.
I'll be that happy when soap isn't rationed anymore.
Dilly's wife scrutinized Mab, curious.
I keep thinking I've seen you before, Mrs. Sharp. Did we meet at one of the Bletchley Park reviews?
Perhaps. I was Mrs. Gray then.
Ah.
Gently, Mrs. Knox took a cup from Mab's hand.
My condolences, dear. I'm glad you've found happiness again.
Mab stared into the water. Eddie, she thought. Lucy. But under the fierce wave of love for her babies welled an ocean of flat, blank nothing. She just didn't choose to admit it was there most of the time.
Dilly was my second love, you know.
Mrs. Knox's voice was thoughtful.
I had a fiancé. He died in France in the First War. My goodness, so long ago. When I got the telegram, I've never been so certain I was going to die. But one doesn't, of course. I thought for a while that I'd never let myself grow so fond of anyone again. But one can't really do that either. Being cut off from life is like being dead. It would have cut me off from a certain very absent-minded papyri-translating professor with a gift for code-breaking and a mania for long baths. That would have been a great pity.
Yes,
Mab made herself say, voice bristle.
There, that's the last cup. I'll see what's keeping Osler.
Escaping into the corridor, Mab stood a moment, rubbing her hands up and down the towel over her dress. And then she saw Osler slumped against the telephone.
Mab stiffened.
What is it?
Osler looked up, smile grim.
I'm dithering about whether I should ring Giles, feed him a line or two while I'm away longer than planned. I can't bear the thought of hearing his voice.
Her finger traced the telephone cord, emerald engagement ring glinting.
I've made a perfect mug of myself, trusting him.
You're not the only one.
Mab thought of the night she ended up drunk in his bed.
Oh, thank God I didn't sleep with him. Lucky you. He's a thumping bore between the sheets.
Mab's lips twitched. Osler's did too, and for a moment they were on the verge of laughter. Then Osler said,
No use putting it off,
and picked up the telephone, and Mab went into the library, where Beth was pacing.
You look like a gothic heroine about to pitch herself down a well,
Mab observed, but Beth just shook her head.
It's no good. I'll never crack it in time. I'm too rusty.
Mab cut her off.
Ring Harry.
Beth flinched.
What?
You don't want to ring Harry,
Mab said impatiently, because you haven't seen him in 3.5 years, and you don't know what you still mean to him, and you don't want to face any of that yet. But we need another brain. Someone to help break those messages and not turn you in.
Mab folded her arms.
Ring Harry.
Beth didn't have time to answer before Osler stamped into the library, face flushed with fury.
If this doesn't just take the biscuit, she snarled. An invitation's come for Giles and me, and I've got to run up to London. Mrs. Knox, she said as Dilly's widow came in with the coffee pot. Can the others impose on you a little longer?
By all means, dear. I haven't had this much excitement since V.E. Day.
Mrs. Knox began passing mugs tranquilly.
Who on earth called you up to London?
Mab asked Osler.
Would you believe the palace?
5 days until the royal wedding. November 15, 1947. Chapter 78.
Your Royal Highness.
Dimly, Osler was aware of Giles's bowing, the other guests fluttering through the private drawing room where they had all been ushered. Osler had no idea who the others were. She kept thinking of them as the camouflage, especially as she made the appropriate half-curtsy and straightened, taking in the smoke-blue dress, the string of pearls, the serene shield of her face, and the steady blue eyes, level with Osler's own.
How do you do?
Murmured Princess Elizabeth. Osler had a flash of memory, running to meet Philip at the train station, face tilted up toward his, realizing she'd forgotten how blue his eyes were. They will have beautiful blue-eyed children.
Delighted to meet you, Miss Kendall.
Pert, pretty Princess Margaret in buttercream yellow, giving a bold glance up and down the dress Osler's mother had brought back from Paris. Ribbed silk and deep lavender, a huge skirt, a wide sash with impressionist flower swirls like a band of Monet's water lilies about the waist.
Smart frock. Dior.
Just be chummy, Osler reminded herself, as everyone was ushered to a table glittering with silver gilt and crystal, and she and Princess Elizabeth sank down opposite each other in a mutual billow of crinoline and unblinking gazes. That's what this whole luncheon is about. Someone in the palace had clearly had enough of those scandal-rag tidbits about Philip's former girlfriend and decided on a little preemptive strategy. Osler and her fiancé, cosy with the princesses over lunch, everyone friends, then a nice mention in the papers the next day. Osler couldn't decide if she wanted to laugh or rage at the bally timing of it all. On one hand, she'd rather have eaten nails than choke down an elaborate lunch with her traitorous fiancé and anyone, let alone her former boyfriend's royal wife-to-be. On the other hand, Giles would think any stiffness on Osler's part was Buckingham Palace jitters, and not because she'd rumbled his game.
And if he's at the palace, he's not thinking about Beth, Mab had pointed out. Watch him, Oz. If he seems worried...
He didn't. He looked utterly chuffed to be here at Buck Place, and Osler felt cautiously optimistic that Beth's guess was right. He hadn't been notified of her escape.
You look smashing, he whispered into Osler's ear as the first course was served. How'd I get so lucky bagging a filly like you?
Because you took a dead set at me when I'd have said yes to the bloody postman, Osler thought.
She'd been giving his seemingly casual proposal a great deal of thought since learning what her fiancé really was. He might have had a first from Cambridge, but Giles didn't run in the crowds she did, crowds he'd been very eager to enter.
Social climber, Osler thought, giving Giles her biggest smile over the turtle soup. I was never a friend to you, just a rung in the ladder.
She was very glad Philip wasn't at lunch today. Unlike her fiancé from hell, he'd have twigged her real mood in 2 seconds flat. Not just her anger, but what lay underneath it. A shiver of fear to be sitting beside a man who would have a woman lobotomized because she wouldn't give him what he wanted. A man capable of anything. A man she was engaged to marry. The future queen took her first spoonful from the shallow Colport dish, and everyone followed suit.
I hope I may present my personal felicitations for your upcoming marriage, ma'am, Osler said, taking the bull by the horns. I wish you every happiness.
A faint softening in the future queen's eyes.
Thank you.
Such a fuss over one day, Princess Margaret said airily. Quite makes me want to run off to the registry office when my time comes. I don't think Philip would be averse either. He's always been one for informality, Miss Kendall. But of course you know that. I shan't tell you the childhood nickname he had for me. It's quite unflattering.
a gleam in Princess Margaret's eye.
What did he nickname you?
Osler would rather have been strapped to a rack than say that Philip had once called her Princess. Giles saved her by launching on a self-deprecating story about school nicknames. A few of the other men laughed. Princess Elizabeth addressed an elderly lady at her side. Turtle soup was replaced by roast partridge and potatoes. Princess Elizabeth came back to Osler with a polite comment about the weather. Osler replied and took a different bull by the horns. The newspaper coverage of the wedding has been quite unrelenting. It must be a relief to know the scrutiny will return to its usual level soon. I'm not here to throw a spanner in your wedding plans, she wanted to say, preferably embroidered on a banner in 3-foot letters. Can I skip dessert and go home? I've got a traitor to collar, and he's sitting here blithering on about his school days. One of the other ladies was asking Giles if there was a date set for their wedding.
June,
he said with a smile, pressing his knee to Osler's under the table. Osler wished she could jab her silver gilt dessert fork into his leg.
We'll be quite unfashionable with the new fashion for winter weddings, ma'am.
An ingratiating smile to the future queen. Osler distinctly saw Princess Elizabeth's jaw tighten as she yawned without so much as parting her lips. You had to respect a woman who could yawn with her mouth closed.
A June wedding?
Princess Margaret knocked back her wine.
Too original.
Some mention was made of Princess Elizabeth's wartime service, and Osler fell gratefully on the change of subject as the partridge was replaced by fluffy crepes doused in apricot jam.
I understand you were with the ATS during the last year of the war, ma'am. What a lark, working with engines and automobiles.
I enjoyed it. A spark lit the princess's blue eyes. You can do a lot if you're properly trained.
Yes, you can, Osler said, thinking of Hut 4.
Princess Elizabeth tilted her head.
Did you serve, Miss Kendall?
I did, ma'am,
biting into a crepe.
I would have been thoroughly ashamed not to do my part.
Not one of the women's branches, I believe.
I wish I could say more, ma'am,
swallowing her crepe.
But I'm afraid your superiors would disapprove.
The future queen looked startled. Osler smiled sweetly. Mark the occasion, the very first time I ever enjoyed BP's song and dance of secrecy, over lunch at a very different BP. Princess Margaret had another glass of wine in hand when luncheon broke up, and she drew Osler to the window as if to point out the gardens.
I'm the one who wanted to invite you, you know. Lilibet wasn't keen at all.
Her eyes glittered with mischief.
Come on, spill. What's Philip like when you get him alone?
Osler blinked, innocent. Princess Elizabeth glanced over at them, then went back to nodding as Giles told her yet another story.
Maybe Philip's no great shakes, considering you've moved on.
Margaret looked at Giles.
Your fiancé is rather nice.
He's a crashing bore.
Strange how a traitor could also be a real yawner. The princess laughed.
So ditch him. One understands the need for a wedding date, but afterward,
I quite agree, Osler said.
Margaret grinned.
You aren't so milk and water as you seem. I didn't think you could be. Philip hates dish rags.
He will be very happy with your sister, I'm sure.
If other people don't muck it up for him, Mummy wasn't keen.
Margaret scrutinised Osler.
Look, you know him. Is he up for this? Can he do it?
Osler remembered her own words to Philip, that last meeting in Euston Station. Do you think you're built for that, playing Albert to her Victoria?
I don't think you are.
The look on his face afterward. Looking at Margaret now, Osler realised she could complicate Philip's entry to this family quite efficiently, with just a few drips of poison.
You can trust him, Osler said. He's not perfect, and you shouldn't expect it. But he's nearly an orphan, like me. And family is everything to people like us.
What about country? Margaret asked Arch. Mummy called him the Hun, you know.
In his own words, he's near committed murder on behalf of the British Empire.
Smiling at Margaret's startled expression.
Perhaps someday, if he really trusts you, he'll tell you about his experiences at Matapan.
Family was everything, Osler thought. And maybe, yearning to get back to Corn's Wood, she had more family than she thought.
That went swimmingly.
Giles was gleeful as they were ushered out.
I can already see tomorrow's write-up. The princesses lunched privately with special friends, including Mr. Giles Talbot and his fiancée, Miss Osler Kendall.
Osler dug in her handbag for her gloves, hoping Giles wouldn't want to take her out for a night of cocktails. Oh, God, if he tried to wheedle her between his sheets, she was going to absolutely heave.
"Excuse me, Miss Kendall."
A footman caught up to them halfway down the burnished hall outside, bowing.
"If you will come back with me, your gloves..."
But there were no gloves when Osler left Giles and returned to the drawing room. Only Philip, standing hands in pockets by the window.
"Hello,"
he said with a crooked smile. Her stomach was suddenly in ropes. "Hello." She wasn't entirely sure what to call him. He'd be elevated to a dukedom on the morning of his wedding, but hadn't received that title yet. He'd renounced Greek citizenship to marry England's princess, so he was no longer Philip of Greece. Philip nodded the footman out, motioning for the door to be left cracked. A private meeting then, Osler thought, but not private.
"I wanted a hello, since I couldn't join you at lunch. How was it?"
"I'm sure you've been filled in." Something told Osler Philip had already spoken to his fiancée. "I hope no one thinks I had anything to do with those scandal rag pieces."
"I know you, Oz. Never your style."
They gazed at each other. Philip looked strange out of uniform, his bright hair no longer picking up the glint of gold braid, but shining over a civilian suit. His eyes landed on her emerald ring.
"I thought you hated green."
She did. Since the Café de Paris bombing, after which her nightmares were studded by flashes of her blood-drenched green gown.
"Osmar of Oz, we'll get you back to the Emerald City right as rain."
"I've learned to tolerate it," Osler said. "Like a lot of other things."
"Margaret thinks your fiancé is a prat."
"Margaret talks too much."
"She also relayed what you said about me."
Pause.
"Thank you. You could have said a good deal to her. It would have made its way to her sister and, well, you could have made things difficult between my fiancé and me. I wouldn't even have blamed you, considering how things ended."
An ocean of words hovered visibly at his lips.
"I didn't behave as I should have, perhaps, or I let myself care more than I should have and you were hurt."
It all remained unsaid. Philip was more contained than Osler remembered, the future consort already weighing every remark. She felt a moment's regret for the boisterous wartime lieutenant who laughed and spoke on quicksilver impulse.
"You look well."
Philip studied her.
"I'd like to see you happy, too. Is Giles Talbot the one to do that?"
"I don't think you're quite entitled to an opinion on my future husband," she said evenly.
"That's fair."
"Don't think I'm eating my heart out, Philip." The twinges of regret could ache sometimes, even now, but Osler's heart was no longer in smithereens. It wasn't heartache now, it was... "What pains me," she said slowly, finding her way, "is that I've never quite been allowed to leave you behind. When can I be Osler Kendall again, not Prince Philip's old girlfriend?" She answered her own question. "I know it will happen eventually. You'll become our future queen's husband. There will be little blue-eyed princes and princesses, and I'll have a husband and children of my own. And people will forget. I just wish it would come sooner, the day my name becomes mine again, not just something to remind people of someone more important." His mouth quirked.
"I might know something about how that feels."
He might, at that. He'd chosen a woman who outranked him, who always would. "If you'd married me," Osler thought, "you'd be a naval lieutenant, maybe a captain by now, free to sail the world, and I'd always be the prince's wife. You'll marry her, and you'll probably never sail into battle again, and you'll always be the queen's husband." "You can do it, you know," Osler said. "What I said at the train station, that you could never play Albert to Princess Elizabeth Victoria. You can do it, Philip. I know you can. She'll need someone like you, and so does England, someone who doesn't take loyalty for granted." Unlike Giles, who had been born into the nation Philip had chosen and fought for, it had thrown his loyalty away.
"Thank you," he said simply. "She makes me happy."
"I'm glad you've found your place in the world, then."
"What's your place, Oz?"
"I'm going to be the wittiest, most successful satirist at the Tatler," Osler said, "with a syndicated column before I'm 30. She said it flippantly, but realized it was exactly what she wanted. Maybe she hadn't let herself realize that, because it seemed like wanting the moon. But Osler decided right now that she was getting a column, and it was going to be a ripping good column too.
"Shall I ring someone at the Tatler?"
Philip asked.
"I could put in a word for you."
"No, I'm going to get it for myself," Osler decided. As soon as she'd wrapped up this business of catching a traitor, that is.
"I look forward to reading your work."
Philip hesitated.
"Friends, Oz, I don't want to lose you."
"You won't."
"Then take this,"
holding out a slip of paper.
"My private line here at the palace.
It's a bit of Mayfair crumpet like me allowed to ring a duke at Buck Place," Osler jibed.
"You're no Mayfair crumpet and you know it."
Philip hesitated.
"Maybe you can't tell me, but I know you did more during the war than type reports."
That knocked Osler for a wicket. "What?"
"People who have been to war, suffered for it in some way. You see the marks, the damage. I knew fellows who couldn't stand loud noises after Matapan, fellows who got the tremors after we were dive-bombed in the Mediterranean. I don't know what you did, Oz. I didn't think about it much at the time. But afterward, when I looked back, I realized, well, from the pattern of your flinches, it can't have just been typing."
Slanting a brow.
"Though you were very good at selling it that way."
Osler stared at him, nearly breathless.
"Tell me one thing," Philip said. "Whatever it was, were you good at it?"
"I was blinking great at it," she said.
"There you are. So no more silly Deb business, eh?"
She grinned. "As the royal consort, you might get permission to find out what I did, possibly. Ask MI5.
"I will."
Philip checked the time.
"I've got to go. Look, don't be afraid to ring if you ever need anything. One of my people will answer it, day or night."
"You have people now?" she teased. He grinned back, coming to kiss her cheek, and she smelled an unfamiliar cologne. "Good to see you, Philip." When Osler was escorted back to Giles, waiting between a mirror and a hideous mid-Victorian still life, he was good-humoured.
"You were gone an awfully long time for a pair of gloves, kitten. Should I be jealous?"
She beamed at Giles, disarming him before she dumped the goods on him. "You're the one who's been tipping off the scandal rags about me, aren't you?" A shot in the dark, but a reasonable one. He had the grace to look chagrined.
"Just once or twice. The things journos pay for tips."
Excellent, Osler thought. She could row with him all the way back to Knightsbridge, and he'd be far too busy scrambling for apologies to even think about inviting her out to cocktails, or, God forbid, to bed. Far too busy to think about Beth either. "You utter rotter, Giles Talbot," Osler shouted, working up some tears as she stamped down the endless palace hall. That shiver of fear his presence gave her subsided in a wash of relief. She could get out of his sight and back to Beth, Mab, and Cornswood by nightfall. Back to the people who mattered.